Richard Rabin is presenting. He is the coordinator of the Lead Poisoning Registry of the Massachusetts Department of Labor since 1990. And Richard.
Okay, good morning. As you've seen from the previous speakers, immigrant workers are exceptionally exposed to a whole host of different hazards. And I'm sorry, am I supposed to, push the left? Okay. So since I work in an occupational lead poisoning registry, my experience is with, in the Massachusetts, particularly the Boston area, is with immigrant workers, particularly Brazilians, who are exposed to lead at particular, mostly as house painters. Now, you would think that this group of workers, when they go to a health center, a community health center, that the treatment that they would get, the attention, would be at least to some degree oriented towards what do they do for their job? What are the hazards that they have on the job? But in fact, my experience has been to the contrary. For the most part, their physicians, their nurses are not particularly concerned. They're not inquiring about what their hazards are. But I did find one network in the Boston area, network of health centers, that in fact did pay attention, at least with regard to their lead exposure when they're house painters. So what I want to talk about, a little bit about just what their lead exposure is, give you a little background, talk to you about what these this network does to get a lot of blood lead testing, what kind of resources this network has to help people around occupational lead poisoning, and then show you what the lead registry, where I work, what the results we see. Now, the lead registry, I'll get to this in a minute, it gets data from laboratories. When people get tested, adults get tested, we get to see the results. Now, Brazilians in Massachusetts, the population has astronomically increased over the last couple of decades. This is official data you're looking at here. This is from Bureau of Census. Particularly the 2006 data is at least from research done by academic researchers, this is a gross underestimate. It's more like 150 to 200,000 Brazilians in Massachusetts. And I also want to point to you that while the U.S. population, working population, is around 7% working construction, in Massachusetts, among the Brazilians, it's about double that. And that includes small employers such as house painting contractors. Lead hazards, just for you, for those who are new to this, health effects. Lead can affect just about every body organ that there is. Kidney disease, nervous system, even last few years, lead has been known as considered a probable carcinogen. Reproductive system. When you do also, if you look to the right, when you do house painting, your normal method of removing the old paint, sanding, heat gun, dry scraping, easily exceed what OSHA considers the so-called safe limit of 50 micrograms per cubic meter, easily exceeding 10, 20 times that limit. The OSHA lead standard has a whole variety of requirements for protecting workers. Employers are supposed to provide regular medical testing, regular blood lead testing, personal protective equipment, methods of reducing the lead exposure. As you might be aware, particularly when it comes to small employers, small house painting contractors, what you see on the screen here is rarely implemented. So what you're hoping is that at least when they go to their physician would find out what they do and draw a blood lead. This is just represents some training that we've been engaged in with this network, with the health centers, with the occupational health center that's affiliated with them. We translated from the California manual that was done for house painters, translated into Portuguese. Now, why don't you see blood lead testing very much from house painters? Well, the employers, to a large extent, don't know what's expected of them as far as blood lead testing goes. And for those that do, they don't want to go to the trouble and the expense of doing that. And the workers themselves, the immigrants, again, Brazilian immigrants in the Massachusetts largely are undocumented. So you have language barriers. You have people who don't know what their rights are. A study was done a few years ago by the Department of Public Health in Massachusetts looking at people who went to community health centers. Do you know what OSHA is? Overwhelming majority, the answer is no. They don't know what their rights are. They don't know what OSHA is. They don't know what workers' compensation is. And as you also heard, there's fear of retaliation. So the testing is largely not getting done by their employers. Now, this is off the website of this network. It is the Cambridge Health Alliance. It's a network of hospital and about 20 community health centers in the Cambridge-Somerville area. And it's your typical community health center services of primary care and affiliated services that they offer. They have multiple language ability, Portuguese, Spanish, English, Haitian, Cape Verdean, a whole variety. So they are very much oriented towards the immigrant community, but now they are affiliated with a hospital-based occupational environmental health center. They have two board-certified physicians there. They see patients both referred by the community health centers, people who come in on their own, and people who are work for a company that would have a contract with the occupational health clinic. Now, but even this network, they do not routinely inquire into and deal with the hazards that people have on the job. It's messy. It's difficult. You're dealing with workers' compensation. You're dealing with employers. You're dealing. You open up a whole can of worms around people's lives outside of the job. You have physicians who have generally very little training in medical school, but they do ask if they see a Portuguese-speaking male adult, what do you do for your for a job, and look into the hazards. And so if it's a house painter, they will, in fact, draw blood. And if it's elevated, they will refer the people to the occupational health people. They're also in the process of going electronic, and also will be providing information on different job hazards, including lead. Now, why is this all happening? Well, it's happening because you have the occupational health people provide grand rounds, resident seminars in lead and in lead exposure. They are available by email, by phone, for consultations, and as I mentioned, people get referred, can be referred to the to the occupational health people. Now, the lead registry where I work is one of 40 nationwide. We get blood lead reports from the laboratories. Under law, they have to report to us. And we do follow up with people who have elevated lead levels so we can find out how they got exposed. As you can see here, we do follow up with blood leads of 25 micrograms per deciliter or higher. And over a third of the people we have are painters, mostly house painters. When we do the follow-up, we ask the physician, the nurse, why did you order the blood lead test? Okay, so if you look under reasons, there are four main reasons. Person was symptomatic. Person came in and said, I want a blood lead test because I think I'm exposed at work or elsewhere. The company is sending the person. It's a medical monitoring program. Or the physician, the nurse said, oh, you work as a house painter or whatever, I'm going to order a blood lead for you because you're probably exposed to lead. Now, as you can see, the CHC stands for this particular network of health centers. Almost half the blood leads drawn are from the initiative of the health center, compared to only about 12% anywhere else that we see. So it's four times the rate. So what's the take home here? Well, the take home, I think, is that you need physicians, nurses who have the information, the training, the awareness to deal with lead as well as other occupational health hazards. And they need the assistance, they need backup to deal with individual cases. That's it.
Thank you, everybody. And so now we have our time for open questions, discussion, maybe starting with if you have questions for Richard or Nadia, who didn't have a chance for questions earlier, or any of the panelists. Mary.
A question for Richard. On the clinics or the painters who 12% that were all initiated by healthcare providers, did you go back to those health centers that didn't? Just to try to raise awareness to the healthcare providers at those other centers?
Funny you should ask. I've just begun a little campaign to go around the state to give talks to these health centers and try to get them to do more testing.
Yeah. Scott?
In your state, at what level do are the labs required to report? Any level?
15 micrograms per deciliter.
15. And do they report the ZPPs as well?
Mostly, yes. They're required to, and mostly they do. But I would say the majority of blood leads, there is no ZPP because they're not being sent by, you know, an employer program. So it's largely not happening.
Okay.
Other questions, comments, how this fits with your own work or thinking on the issues? Mary?
Well, since a lot of my work is with young workers, many of them in restaurants, I was curious if in your program in Rock, New York, if they have young people involved or if there's any emphasis on reaching out to young workers in restaurants?
There is. I mean, I would say there hasn't been much of an emphasis on very young workers, like, you know, let's say adolescent workers, but most of the immigrant workforce in New York City in the restaurant industry is between in the age range of 20 to, I'd say, 35, late 30s. So there, I would say the majority of Rock New York's members, they have a membership of about 2,000 right now. The majority would be in that age range.
And Mariella, did you have youth in your focus groups or
they
not?
They were about 20 to 35 years old as well.
Same group.
At least in the restaurants.
Okay. Yes.
With the taxi workers, if they're independent contractors, if the contractors renew annually or whatever, and then could they not put something in their contract about health?
Well, that is the long-term goal in terms of the creation of a health insurance fund in particular. The way the taxi industry is structured is they are basically drivers lease or rent their car from garages and brokers, and they also have what's called a medallion, which is essentially a permit to drive. And so the idea is to actually hold, in particular, the garages and brokers somewhat responsible for that, so that they would pay into a system. But their argument really is that drivers should be responsible for their own health care because they're their own employees. So there's a lot of resistance from the garages and brokers.
Yeah. Yes. Hi, Luis.
Yeah, I have a question for the managers. Great presentation on the stress. Yeah, I'm just wondering if when you determine, if they determine depression, anxiety, is that done by just asking them? Like, is there mental health people will tell you there's, a whole range of depression, for example. So are you going to go back and try to, get those people treated somehow? Or?
That kind of follow-up I don't believe you were planning on doing, and I think it was used interchangeably in depression and anxiety. I don't think we defined it very clearly to them which one.
So there's a real need for anyone to get, like, say, EAP or counseling?
Yes, absolutely.
All real good
I think the great thing about with these particular women in these focus groups that there was going to be some kind of follow-up with these women at the community level.
Yeah, because you're working with community
clinics. Community-based organizations, yes. Right. They weren't necessarily clinics, but they were community-based organizations.
Yeah. Pam?
As Nadia, if you could give a little bit, a little bit of an analysis of what the scope nationally of these worker centers and what they're trying to do. Are they working together?
Sure, definitely. I mean, I can give you really an example from each of the organizations. So Rock New York has officially gone national. There's a Rock United, and they are based out of New York City. But after the success of Rock New York, some of the organizers and the organizing committee went to New Orleans to establish a Rock New Orleans. They've established a Rock Chicago, and I believe a Rock Detroit. And from that, there was really movement from the workers in each of those sites to think about creating a national effort. And the way they see themselves is really as a counterpoint to the National Restaurant Association, which is really primarily consists of employers. Employee voices are not represented in that organization. So that's sort of where they see themselves going in the long term. And the Taxi Workers Alliance has done a similar thing. There's a TWA in Los Angeles and several other cities. However, they've gone even more international in scope because of the way migration patterns really affect the taxi industry. So there are areas in Pakistan, for example, where almost the whole village is consists of taxi drivers who have come to New York City to drive. So their goal is to really make a national effort and start organizing from even before people are in the industry. So there are definitely, and that was one of the reasons I wanted to do this study, is because I think there's a thought that worker centers may not be effective and that they're very much at the local level. But you know what I found is that there's really movements towards national and international work.
Yeah, if you don't already know each other, Pam is working on a study in Chinatown with Chinese restaurant workers. Okay, back to Mary.
I'm trying to be equal opportunity, but Suzanne.
Hanging your projector.
When you were, I might have to stand up and like, I'm only talking to the bathroom machine. Yeah. You talked about building trust, and then you talked about how there was concern that people thought you were only trying to, not you, but the activity was only trying to gain new members.
Building personal connections and I'll stand up to look at you. Of both the building the personal connection and the investment of time and energy in helping them, not so much like what I talked about with our agenda is health and safety or our agenda is getting you to be a member. But that in and of itself was that the organizers and unions started to try to do stuff like set up ways for people to send money home more without paying the high fees that some of the other couriers charge, helping them just understand how to get housing and set up and help being more of a resource center for the workers. And then through those personal connections and when people saw that they were investing time in them and in what mattered to them, that's how they were describing being able to do that. As well as training Latino workers to be the organizers or to be the voice of the union. I mean, several unions commented on what a radical difference there was when there was the white organizer that went in versus the Latino organizer that went in starting to talk about the union benefits and links. So I think that's how they represented that, and just in really investing time and putting resources into their priorities and not your priorities.
Yeah.
Well, like, not even answer the same question.
Yeah.
I'm curious about, because the restaurant workers, because the union was involved in it, and now it's expanding nationally, and I'm even having trouble figuring out what is this, as part of the union organizing, or is it the worker center itself? Not that those are necessarily mutually exclusive, but it's kind of.
It's contentious.
How it's as a union organizing strategy.
Right.
Vis-a-vis kind of workers center. They're, let's say the same thing occurred, but you didn't have the union involved in it. I mean, how would it unfold differently, or how might it?
I mean, I think you really have to look at the context. When Rock New York emerged, the argument of many of the members and the organizers were that, the union hasn't made an effort to really represent our interests. And there weren't, culturally appropriate organizers or organizers that were from my background. And so I think, especially in the beginning when Rock New York sort of branched out and became its own organization, it was very contentious with the union, and that was something that the organizers told me about a lot. I think now the way they see it is they're saying, our effort is not to become a union, and we, it takes a lot of work to build that trust, to really build the connections with workers, and that's how they see their role. And they're very amenable to saying, well, once we brought in workers, to let them know, well, there is this union, and that you the union is important as well. So they are trying to maintain that relationship.
Dorothy?
My question goes to the construction experience. partly because I worked for 2 years around the Construction Occupational Health Project in the Boston area. And I, one of the things with which I walked away was a conversation I had one day. These are folks, I was talking to operating engineers who operate the heavy-duty equipment, working with them a lot. And I've always remembered this middle-aged guy saying, me asking him about an incident that occurred where there had been some pretty nasty things directed towards a woman on the site. And he was talking about how the operating engineers had changed from being a union of Irish to the exclusion of everyone else, to Irish men. And how he would even encourage his daughter to get him into something big. So I'm curious, in the work that you were looking at, were there any women involved? And what was being done, if anything, to support women, immigrant women, getting involved in those units?
That's a good question. Because I think it was challenging enough to find at times models of what's being done to support immigrant workers. I mean, there are some unions that are much more on the forefront around that, but I talked earlier about the challenges that they're confronting from members that don't want, that some, you know, have those sort of established views of what kind of union they are. So I don't think anything jumps out from the research we did here, in particular trying to support women, immigrant women construction workers. There is a woman at the International Laborers, Yarina Merino, who is, she's not an immigrant construction worker, but she is looking for the labor. She's their immigrant worker liaison. And she comes more, I think, from a worker center or community organizing background. And anyway, I'm going to follow up on that with her, because her role, and that's actually something unique that the laborers did, is designate a person at the international level to really look at immigrant issues and connect with locals about ways that they could partner with community groups and immigrant rights groups.
Yeah, it was interesting, because one of the co-sponsors of this activity was the State Building and Construction Trades Council, California, and the person from there, Deborah, is very, very active in women in the trades and has an annual Women in the Trades conference. But it is interesting that there wasn't any crossover really in this conference.
And part of the reason we bring that up, aside from the gender bias, is that certainly my experience as qualitative entirely was women's occupational qualifications on construction sites were quite, well, overlapped. But there really were different ones at times. And so if you're going to be getting people involved in immigrants trying to, you know, go after issues that are important, if you aren't framing, if it's not being framed as something that relates to women, then
right.
Why would they want to be part of this?
Do you mean women who are immigrant workers or women who should be engaged in supporting immigrant workers? I'm curious.
So immigrant women.
Immigrant women, construction workers.
Just if you're not addressing their issues as female workers, uh-huh. Never mind immigrant workers, uh-huh. They're not like involved. And I think there's a lot of, it's just missed a lot in construction health to think of some of that, uh-huh. Looking at where there might be women's issues.
Okay, thanks. Rosie, did you?
Yeah, I don't know if I have a question. I mean, just reflecting back on the issue, on the challenges of unions and worker centers, and especially with women and immigrant workers, I guess it's more a question about what ongoing efforts. I realize construction is a little different in that there's so few women in construction, so few immigrant women in construction right now. But certainly in the restaurant workers unions, or outreach efforts, that shouldn't be such an issue. And I guess I'm just reflecting back a comment that I don't have an answer to. The worker centers that are kind of generic worker centers in the Chicago area, one of them at least started out looking at the issue of women. The Latino Union in Chicago started looking at the issue of women in cleaning and other positions, but has kind of evolved into almost an exclusive focus on street corner day labor, which you know, then again segregates into male and female. And so the issue of crossing genders and crossing front of the house and back of the house workers in union and non-union, the Unite Here, which did give a start to Rock New York, but then, you know, kind of the challenges that emerged after that. My question is, what are the efforts going on right now to facilitate communication across those, and does anybody on the panel have examples of that kind of cross communication?
But like, Larasa has both the day labor and domestic labor. You mean communication where women are concentrated in certain jobs and men, immigrant workers, in other jobs?
Or worker centers and unions. Worker centers can be on one level, and making sure that in worker centers or in unions, that men and women's issues get. I mean, I guess I'm just repeating what Dean and what we've already heard.
Well, at the said. Just one quick mention is at the national level, and then so that in terms of construction. You know, historically, there's been a lot of tension between union locals or building trade councils and day labor centers in different cities. But a couple of years ago, in 2006, the AFL actually entered into a historic agreement with the National Day Labor Organizing Network, which is a network of day labor worker centers across the country where they were going to try to collaborate and work together. And they were going to allow centers to affiliate with the AFL. And that is something that I actually need to follow up on to see what, you know, has come of it. I know the people who were working on that on the AFL side, their first a plan in their program was to identify opportunities for partnership between union locals and at day labor centers at the, you know, in specific cities. I think there's something between the painters and the Day Labor Center in LA that was getting set up, and but that was a real, just policy-wise, you know, for the AFL to acknowledge mm-hmm. these day labor worker centers and allow for that exchange, and also to not have their first explicit goal be to organize those workers, mm-hmm. but to still support the day labor centers, and obviously in the long term, they're hoping that those workers will eventually come into the union, but that recognizing that they have to work with those worker centers first.
Did you want to add something?
I mean, there's a specific example with the Taxi Workers Alliance. They were asked to become a member of the CLC last year. So they're the first worker center that was asked to become, you know, a member of the Central Labor Council. So I think that's one example. And then just in terms of gender issues, I will note both of the worker centers are female-led. And in the taxi industry in particular, it's unusual because that's a 99% male industry, but the main organizer is a female organizer. It's the same with Rock New York. Saru was the lead organizer. I think particularly at Rock, they're addressing gender issues through their next campaign that they're really focusing on is a discrimination campaign. And again, like I said, they really focus on research and documentation. The project that they just finished was what's called a matched pair study. And they sent out a worker of color and a Caucasian worker, or a male and a female worker, two different restaurants to look at employment opportunities and look at where they were placed based on gender, based on ethnicity, based on things like accent. And they're coming out with a report regarding that in the next few months, I think.
In Massachusetts, MassCosh, the Coalition for Occupational Safety and Health, is coordinating a worker center. It's been doing that for a few years now. And it actively, I mean, it encourages people to unionize, and it hooks them up with unions that are apply to whatever industry that group of workers is concerned with. And it's kind of curious that the one woman that I see that has been active, she's the only woman that I've seen active in this. She is the most active and the most tied into doing this kind of work, much more than any of the men.
Okay, I think we're probably right at the end of our time, so I want to thank our wonderful panel and our wonderful audience. Thank you.